Sweet.
Welcome back to a mid-season, almost close to late season episode of the Colorado Bowhunters Association, CBA's ABCs of podcasting. I almost forgot the name there. I'm here with Henry Ferguson. Trevin's out still chasing animals around, so we'll catch up with him on the next one. But Henry and I want to give you guys a little bit of an update, and I want to hear about this velvet buck that's actually right in front of me. So I'm over here at Henry's place sitting in his trophy room, or I don't know if I should call it that.
It's just our front room.
Front room with a beautiful collection of a lot of deer, some elk, and I saw some antelope upstairs, which is super
cool.
Yeah, the
elk are accidents. Those are here by by total happenstance.
Barge their way in. Well, that's, I mean, I'm interested in your knowledge of mule deer, but the elk has been my first Western pursuit.
Sure.
So that's what I'm starting to gain a better knowledge of, and I'm curious as to your responses to my experiences this season, and I also just want to hear about yours. But so sure. far, since we've last talked, how you been? How's the season going? How's life been? And
it's been pretty chaotic, and for us, I mean, our family, we've been going through a few little things, but I mean, it's been a lot, man. Since we last talked, let's see, throw in probably 20 scouting trips, two trips to Utah for a deer tag. I hunted the whole season here, you know, and got my buck, and
nice.
Had virtually no close encounters with elk because elk just don't like me. I don't understand it. I mean them nothing but, you know, goodwill. And, you know, I'll give them a nice place to rest for the rest of their time.
Yeah.
Then my son got a reissued rifle antelope tag for my son. And he shot a nice buck.
Nice.
So, yeah, it was just – it's been a lot going on here. And I can't wait because we've got – my wife and son have a couple of second season tags, so we'll be back out and at it this weekend. And
so exciting.
As tired as I am chomping at the bit. I can't wait to get back out there because, man, I mean, I just live for this. You know,
yeah.
I mean, these are the 2 to 3 months a year that, I mean, my wife probably won't listen to this, so I can just go ahead and say these are the 2 to 3 months of the year that really matter the most. So,
yeah, it's interesting being in it because there's like the anticipating it, the scouting, getting really tuned in archery wise, also making sure your rifle's dialed in. And then you have opening day and it all becomes not only real, but you're like immediately wishing for another opening day. At least I am in my elk experience.
Exactly right.
That's one big takeaway I had this year is like last year, my first day of hunting was the third day of the season. This year, I took off 2 days before season opener.
I noticed that. I liked that.
And it made a huge difference in the number of elk I was seeing, the encounters I was having, but also just in that like anticipatory. Last year, I felt late to the game, and this year, okay, I'm ruling first choices out, second choices out, I'm making up game plans, and then it's like the night before you're supposed to have opening day, and it's like, I have to make a choice. I have to choose one option, and it's going to be my highest chance at success due to pressure, but how do I... The 365 that I was waiting for from last year from opening day is here, and I'm like scared shitless almost.
Well,
what choice to make?
I love that. Scared shitless, perfect analogy for it. Because truthfully, this is the big dance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like you said, you've been anticipating this for 335 days, you know, since the last one ended.
Yeah.
And you've put your work in, you've been at the range. You've been scouting, you've been looking at maps, you've been working to get yourself in shape physically.
Right.
You're ready.
Yeah.
But are you ready?
That's just it.
I mean, there's always this little shred of doubt of, oh my gosh, what if this happens? And you start what-ifing yourself to death. And there's a point at which when you've had a couple successful hunts, after you kind of calm down a little bit.
Yeah.
But I can tell you right now, I'm a mess. I told you my wife and son have second season tags starting this weekend.
Right.
I've already begun the not sleeping phase of my hunt prep because I anticipate this so much. And I mean, it's funny because it just means and I don't know, maybe it means too much to me, mm-hmm. if I'm being totally honest, but I love being out there. I love being outdoors. I love seeing, I mean, this weekend, these rifle hunts, I love seeing my family succeed.
Oh yeah.
I mean, if you can find me something better than that, I'd love to see it, because I haven't found it. It's watching, you know, your family, your, like my son, my wife, when I've seen them lay down and get ready to take that shot for the first time, I mean, I'm sure their heart's beating, mm-hmm. but mine is about to burst out of my chest, because there's this certain level of, I know what I'm going to do in the moment of truth.
Mm-hmm.
I know how I'm going to react and, you know, but I'm not 100% sure how they are.
Right.
I am now. I mean, I know what they're going to do. I've seen them produce time and time again, but that anticipation is, mm-hmm. whether it's for your own hunt or for somebody else's, is just awesome.
And it really is.
That just drives you.
And it's fun experiencing the different versions of it, because I was so excited to go solo hunting, really not have to run ideas through anybody. You're like solely responsible for the outcome, but also you don't have to answer to anybody. Why did we go left? I told you we should have done this afternoon, whatever.
Yeah.
And I also went on a rifle hunt with some friends for Rifle One, and my buddy got one, and just so excited that he got one. And that's my friend, not my kid, not my wife. Yeah. So just that level of seeing like familial success, I could only imagine. Well, it's like, well, we're all bringing home the bacon now.
Yeah, I mean, I was with a couple of my friends when they got their first animal, and I mean, it's just this overwhelmingly awesome experience, you mm-hmm. know, seeing somebody put in the work. And I mean, you know, my buddy Tim's a great example. I mean, I sat there and we worked hard on getting him ready to hunt.
Yeah.
And when he went down on a stalk on this little buck, I mean, it's a little forky about, and it was a pretty funny story, because it was way the heck back in there.
Yeah.
And he sneaks down there and puts up a textbook picture perfect stalk, gets in range, and he shoots, and I mean, just could not have walked up there and poked it in him any better. It was just awesome. And man. I mean, that overwhelming sense of, holy crap, that was so cool.
Yeah.
And it's just great.
It really is. I'll jump ahead, and then I want to ask you about your archery mule deer, but sure. I am getting ready to go to New York a week from the day we're recording this, for whitetail hunt.
Oh, cool.
And I had a little mishap with my bow that we'll get into during archery elk. And so I'm retuning in, and I'm resighting in broadheads. And just that thing you were talking about earlier, of all the different versions of preparation, physical, scouting, mental, emotional, with your weapon, everything.
Yeah.
And to like have one of those things reset at this point in the season is always a little nerve wracking.
It's damn near overwhelming.
Yeah.
This was years ago. I snuck in I was up glassing, and I put a buck to bed in a spot that was just done.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, the wind was right. Everything was right. Everything was in my favor.
Mm-hmm.
That buck was about to get a backpack ride, and I was about to have a great, you know, great set of antlers on the wall and a full freezer. And I literally get nervous before stocks.
Yeah.
So this whole nervous thing, it doesn't leave me until I'm at full draw. That's when I usually calm down, because that's where it's like my happy place. I've shot thousands of arrows throughout the year,
mm-hmm.
each of them focusing on perfect execution. So when I hit full draw, I'm confident then. That's when things settle down for me. And I know that's not the way for everybody, but I mean, that's, you know, for me, that's when the world kind of makes sense. But,
right.
So before I go on this stock, first thing I always do, no great way to say it, I take a leak.
Yeah.
Because my bladder gets to be about the size of a lima bean when I'm nervous. So I take a leak, and I'm taking a leak, zip up, I look over at my bow, and I look down, and something just caught me as not right.
Uh-huh.
I took a closer look at my sight, and my sight pin, I shoot a single pin sight. My sight pin was bent about 30 degrees off to the side.
How does that happen? It's inside the housing, right?
Terrific question, Jake. wish I had an answer for it.
Strong stream.
Hey, yeah. So I'm freaking out. I'm like, oh no, this isn't good, man.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I can just very gingerly and gently bend this thing back straight.
Sure, 'cause
this
can.
Stock, Jake, this could be 20-yard shot. Uh-huh. I'm about to dump this thing from, you know, close range. So I am very gently bending it back near this tank, and I feel it just snap in my hands. So literally, rather than go up there and risk making a bad shot,
yeah,
strap my pack back up and walked back down the mountain.
Wow.
And found a replacement scope housing from Bill Pellegrino.
Wow.
In Colorado Springs. Thanks, Bill. But that, you
it's
know,
the right
it just
choice,
cost me
but
that day.
Man.
But yeah, I mean, I don't regret the choice.
Yeah.
I regret having to make the choice. Mm-hmm. But so what happened to your bow? What are you working?
So this year I bought one of those Baku e-bikes. I actually sold my motorcycle.
Yeah.
And the place I was hunting last year, I realized that it's accessible on ATVs. It's BLM land. And there are some power lines on the ridges. So there's some good roadway in there.
Oh, yeah.
I actually got the Baku, in the spring. I had went out to the same unit, in July to see if the bike could handle what I needed it to handle. It got to the very far edges of like the property boundaries. And I was like, this is perfect. If I get something out, I can get it out a mile or two to the road and then two or three miles back
to
the truck.
You bet.
No way I could do 5-6 miles round trip more than twice, like maybe not even three times. So just trying to like understand my limits, but want to be in the action. It's a balancing act.
Oh, it's always a balance.
Here.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily about I walked further than the next guy. Like my suffer fest was better than your suffer fest. I realized like it's, if you
welcome
get it done
to the internet,
it's
folks.
Hard. I'll tell you about my opening day because that was the most exciting. But the bike thing, the bow thing, I was returning back to my truck midday, and things that would take me 2 hours take me 20 minutes on the bike.
And that's so cool.
Even like with 40, 50 pounds on the trailer, like it's just effortless.
Oh, yeah. You've got the trailer and everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's
so
awesome.
It really has been a game changer for like comfort, for endurance. And there was a part in the trail that gets super soft because it's just churned up by ATVs and it's like on a down banking turn.
Oh, okay.
And midday I had washed out on it, but kind of like just landed on my hands in front of me and didn't like roll or anything. Got back on the bike, got back to the truck, had lunch, dried my gear off, went back out there. That same night, I took the same spill in the same location. My bow was strapped to my backpack and I rolled on my back.
Gotcha.
The next day, I had relocated to a different unit, and I was checking out a spot that I was hadn't been to before, but I knew it had held some animals. And so I talked to some other hunters in the unit. Side note, I find it's very funny that if you try to talk to a hunter at a gas station, they're very cagey. But if you talk to a hunter at a trailhead, they'll tell you every single thing they know about that area.
That's funny.
They're just so excited to share. And it's like a very useful tip. It's like if you get to the spot that you both know about, they'll tell you, yeah, yesterday I saw one on that ridge. And 2 days
by then,
ago.
They already know half of what they know at least.
Yeah, it feels more like camaraderie than it does competition.
Yeah.
So I talked to a few guys and they're like, I was like, I think there's a little bowl up there. I want to check that out. He's like, that's perfect. We're the only ones back here. Go check it out. And so I put my bow on my back. I go up and I come up to this rise and I go, there's a small chance there's elk on the other side of this rise. Let me take my bow off my bag. Let me draw it back one time just to make sure it's the first time of the day.
Yeah.
And I start to pull it back. And within the first inch, just like these crazy crunching, creaking sounds.
Oh, gosh.
And I look and my yokes came off the cams. So my thing was completely canted. Yep. And I just, for one moment, tried to push my 70-pound limbs down by hand.
How'd that work out for you, Jake?
Real loss cause. I was like, you're going to cause so much more damage than you are going to solve this. So put it back on my back, went over the rise. There were no elk. But
thank goodness, because that would have been even worse had there been elk and you had an inoperable bow.
But went to No Limits. I had when I ordered the bow, I'd ordered a secondary pair of strings and immediately had them on. So I had the...
Oh, cool. So you had the original strings there.
They've swapped it out. And actually, I went to shoot and my tuning didn't change at all. I was shocked. That's awesome. So that was that issue. But why don't I tell you a little bit about my opening day and then you tell me about your successful mule deer hunt. I was working in Aspen the Monday, before the season opener. Season opened on a Thursday, I think.
Yeah.
So I had worked a half day and then I took off the rest of the week and I went out and scouted like a tertiary and secondary spot that I was really interested in. And one thing I learned about this unit is there's two really nice chunks of BLM and one of them is completely landlocked. It used to have a county road on it, and I found out by talking to another hunter who talked to BLM what this landowner made an agreement with the county that he'll plow the roads if it's no longer a county road, and that closed off all public access to this unit. So that's why I realized where I do hunt is so busy, because everybody who's done some exploring in this area found the one place you could go.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So I get in Tuesday night to the unit and I am seeing hundreds of elk. There's a nice chunk of like meadow land that's on private right next to this public, and there was 115 elk out on the meadow like the day before, the day 3 days, 2 days, and the day before opener.
Oh wow.
There was six or seven bulls, a nice herd bull, tons of cows, tons of spikes. And then within the BLM, I was seeing pockets of dozens of elk. So I probably saw 200 to 250 elk before opening day on huntable land, which was like, holy shit.
That's the dream, yeah.
And it's so funny because it's the same place I hunted last year, but on the third day of the season, you would have never known that that's what it looked like just earlier that week.
Yeah.
So I do a ton of scouting. One of my favorite scouting moments was there's one guy driving down the BLM, the ridge line, because you could pay a woman trespassing fees. She has a gate that conveniently crosses, and then you can drive this place with a 4x4. And so he's driving. He looks pretty old, and he's like calling out, and he's like, "Yeah, I don't see my friends. I don't see my friends." And then I was like, "All right, like I'll keep an eye out." I start glassing and I hear a few gunshots go off, and it was like before opening day. And I was like, geez, what the fuck?
Seriously.
And I like go down, I see him. He's like, "Yeah, I'm trying to get their attention." What are you doing, man? Eventually they come up to the roadway. He's far gone, but the only way to come is to come back. So I told them, I was like, "Guys, hang on the roadway. Your buddy's looking for you." 70+ year old guys from Pennsylvania, two of them on foot, just trudging along. And they're like, these Italian guys, and like, "Jake, man, you're a real hunter, man. I really look up to you." I was like, "What? Because I didn't drive back here?" But it's really cool to see guys who are 40 years my senior, and I'm like, "Man, you're doing this where I'm doing this,
absolutely,
that is an inspiration." So I'm seeing all these elk and realizing, okay, the camps are filling in. People do know about this spot. Some guys come every year, some guys come every couple of years, but guys know about it. Mm-hmm. So as opposed to hunting directly off the drivable ridge lines, because it's just where people will be.
Yeah.
I was like, let me go to the middle finger ridge. I'll camp there for the night and I'll go down, down into the bottom of the drainage and hopefully.
Yes, everybody. I did notice that he said middle finger ridge as well. Go ahead. Carry on, Jake.
I say that because there was five ridges. That helps the story too. And I'd got back to my truck midday on Wednesday before opener. There's drizzling. I was like, "All right, let me let the rain pass and then I'll go in there." The rain didn't pass. It just got worse and worse and worse. So I load up my bike, I load up my rain gear, and I go like the 2.5-3 miles. And because of these very conveniently placed gates, what I think happened is this woman's family owned a ton of this land, and eventually the BLM bought it back. She kept the convenient corridors and now charges like $1,200 a week per person.
Dang.
For a combo.
Nice gig if you can get it, huh?
Real nice gig, yeah. So I have to take a gnarlier route to get to where I want to camp for that night, and it was a mess. By the time I got there, head to toe covered in mud, bike covered in mud, put my gear in a bunch of trash bags. It was all covered in mud.
Oh,
I set up a tarp so I can set up my tent under the tarp, trying to stay dry. I finally get in the tent, finally dry off, make a meal. It's about 6:30, 7 p.m. Wednesday before opener. Rain stops. Clouds start to dissipate. I get out of my tent. I go 500 yards over a rise. Not even 200 yards over a little rise. There's a 4x4 bull like 300 yards from camp.
Right by camp.
I was like, holy shit.
There you go.
This is crazy. So then that thing we were talking about earlier, what do I do? Now yeah. I have this knowledge. Do I hunt this thing tomorrow morning, or am I scared everybody else is going to push this thing down the drainage? So let me get down the drainage first. That night, as I'm like getting ready to go to bed, I see a headlamp, and this like old guy named Bob comes up with a huge backpack on, and I was like, "Hey man, how are you?" He's good, and he started like heading down right where the elk are.
Right where, oh man!
And I was like, "Hey, like I'm kind of camping here because I saw just a ton of fresh sign. I didn't want to disturb it." He's, "Oh, I like to get right up in it."
Oh gosh.
And that's what I realized. It's like, to each his own.
Well, and you know, there's a lot of different strategies that can lead to success.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's worked out for him in the past.
It probably has.
Yeah. But man, yeah. That's,
it just, it's like, I can only control what I can control.
I'm on, I would have taken an approach way more similar to yours though.
The first night, like bless this guy. He's like, all right, if it's cool with you to camp next to you, then I was like, please, if it's yeah. going to prevent you from going down there, then yes,
absolutely.
So opening morning 4:35 AM geared up. And I start heading down in the dark, down this like game trail.
Good. So you were going after that bull then?
Actually, I didn't. And he comes back into my life later this day.
Okay.
But one thing that was crazy was as I'm going down this game trail, it starts to get a little thicker. And you just start to hear like, chuka-chuka, chuka-chuka. And it's just elk galloping through the woods because you're bumping them like 20 yards,
yeah,
30 yards.
That's the risk of going in the dark. I mean, it truly is.
And it makes you like, I want to know, but it's a little foggy. What do I do?
Oh,
and,
yeah, because it had rained the day before. Mm-hmm. So, yep.
So I was sure. Let me just get in it. So I get in it, bump a ton of elk. Everybody's doing the same thing. You're hearing other guys bumping elk. Like, it is just like an army walking down this ridgeline.
Oh, man.
I eventually get open to a little meadow, and I start cow calling a little bit, and immediately, like, a spike comes right up. It didn't have brow tines. I knew it wasn't legal. Geez. So I was like, oh, shit, like, be ready. Like,
yeah.
This is very real. It's not just, like, playing around
head
or
on
glassing.
A swivel. That's right. It's playing for keeps now.
So my instinct was to, like, drop off to the right side of the ridge as I'm going downhill, and immediately I see a spike behind a bush. And so I stop, and I see a spike, a cow, and a spike. And I know I can shoot the cow. And so I watch them go behind this bush, 10 yards. I get to full draw. And if he takes two more steps, I'm going to shoot this thing. They curve off down to the right and go down the hill. I don't think they smelled me. I think they're just walking around.
Yeah, that was
so full draw an hour into open air.
Opening morning.
Oh, my God.
That's awesome.
So thrilling. Because I know I've told this story before, and it could go on and on and on. I had over 20 elk within 20 yards of me throughout the day.
Wow.
On opening day, probably
wow.
5 or 6 different times.
And no shot opportunities.
So the next shot opportunity I'll get to, I decide to go back up to the top of the ridge and drop down the left side as we go down the hill. And I immediately bump 5 mature cow elk, like huge elk. And I was like, I could chase them through this thicket, but it's just going to be me chasing them and chasing them and chasing them. Let me drop down to the drainage. Let me climb up the mountain. I'm looking at and look back at where I was.
There you go.
I drop down. I refresh my water. I climb up to the top, take my boots off, take my shirt off, take everything off, just kind of chilling, looking through the glass. I see those cows. I actually am looking at where I was just standing and watched the 4x4 bull from the night before walk within 10 yards of where I was sitting. And I was like, you wouldn't know it.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have no clue it's going to happen.
No.
But patience is something that I need to learn about a little bit.
Well, it's tough. It truly is. That's
so
tough.
I see these cows that I bumped, and I was like, let me start cow calling. I'm a little hesitant to immediately start ripping bugles because I feel like that pushes things away, calls other hunters in. No one's really coming to a cow call. Maybe some other hunters, but I start cow calling, and they don't really care. But out of the corner of my eye, something very close to me just moved, and I notice it's a legal spike. And again, my shoes are off, my shirt is off, my bow's to my side. I scramble, hands and knees, knock an arrow on the string. I stand up, it comes around the bush, I come to full draw, and I didn't knock my arrow properly, and the arrow falls off the string. So I didn't get to shoot the second time for that day,
man.
Opening day. It was so thrilling, but in that 4 hours, I learned more about elk hunting than I have in the past 2 years.
Yeah.
Proximity, calling, setups, like so much.
Well, knowing when to move, when to stay put, when, you know, how to move and what, there's just so many variables.
Yeah.
And I've always, you know, it's something I've told my son, that, you know, 1,000 things have to go right just to get a shot with a bow.
Yeah.
Just to get a shot. That doesn't mean you're going to hit it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean you're going to kill it, but you need 1,000 things to just go right.
Yeah.
Just to put yourself in that position to feel that anchor point and, you know, be ready to make the shot. But that's why it's so exhilarating.
And
when it does happen, there's not many things better.
And it happens out of nowhere. Like, I noticed that the ebb and flow of hope when I'm tree stand whitetail hunting is very different. Cause like you see it, you hear or see something, it's a squirrel. Okay. I'm
90% done. Of the time it's a stinking squirrel.
Yeah. Or like you see something, it's exciting, it's gone, and you don't know what's going to happen for the next 10 hours.
Yeah.
With elk hunting, every like 20 minutes on opening day, if you're in the right spot, can be like incredibly thrilling. And like the quick lessons learned that I'll review is like, if you have an elk call in your mouth, don't take a sip of coffee between calling and expecting to like see an elk. Cause I was just being complacent. I was like, all right, let me relax. I'll call a little bit. Well, a cow elk came within 15 yards of me.
So were they responding to your calls
were cows and spikes were responding to the cow calls on opening morning,
awesome.
Like all day,
awesome.
4 or 5 times I had curiosity, strike me from these animals. So, opening day, morning, I was at full draw. Afternoon, I was at full draw. And then I just hiked it back up to camp. I basically did like a 5-mile loop, dropping like 1,500 and gaining like 1,500 at elevation. So it wasn't a heavy day, but it wasn't a light day.
Yeah.
The next day, I realized like pressures is going to be very different. The amount is probably 10x less of like interaction of animals.
Okay.
And maybe that's a little extreme, but just that idea of like, if I'm seeing hundreds of elk, I might only see like dozens of elk or tens of elk.
That's a safe assumption.
Yeah.
They don't love pressure.
No.
And they will avoid it. They know ways to avoid it.
And that's so like another quick lesson learned is like elk, in my experience, will choose a less desirable watering hole or feeding area when pressure's on.
Yeah.
Like if you think here's the best choice and the second best choice, they'll go to some little shitty seep because they don't want to die.
Yeah.
So that makes a lot of sense.
Well, generations of experience have been passed down to them to put them into that, to give them that knowledge base. Yeah.
So that night closes. I go to bed and I hear some ATVs coming in and I was like, it's not new guys. These guys must be helping somebody get an elk out. So I unzip my tent. I see the last ATV drive away, giant bull elk on the back of it.
Oh.
Right near where I was camping. So I just made a note. I was like, I generally know where this guy hunted.
Okay.
Next morning, I try to put a spot and stalk on a spike that I saw from 40 yards off, and he was just always a few steps in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
So uneventful morning. I actually ended up flushing a grouse, shooting a grouse with a $70 arrow, and it was skylined. I didn't have a grouse point. I had an iron will two blade. It went straight through the grouse. The grouse
as it should
soared off into the valley. So the grouse went hundreds of yards into the thick. The arrow went away. And I was like, what was that for? Why did you do that?
Jake, this is a lesson that we have all learned in that exact manner.
Oh my God.
I mean, we've all done it.
I thought it'd be so cool to make lunch while I'm hunting. Yep, well, $100 and a little like heartache later. Because I do feel bad about wounding animals. Like, you're never proud of it, but it's just like,
oh man,
facepalm. So stupid.
Yep.
I punished myself that afternoon with like a little bit of a curiosity hike. I was like, that looks dangerous and thick.
Go check out some new territory.
Yeah.
Burn it off.
Earn it a little bit. That afternoon, I was like, let me go deeper than where I saw that elk get pulled out of on the ATV the night before. Let me go to the edge of the property boundary. There's a lot of coal land around this area. And so I was just like, let me see what's going on. I go to the edge of the coal land. I get there about like 1:30. It's like right, this valley cuts right through the public and the private. And I get there and immediately on private see like a bundle of elk. And I say a bundle because I thought it was like cows. And I just start rushing as hard as I can. They're half a mile from me. So I start just ripping through the bush, like no trails, no nothing, like getting to the farthest point.
This is kind of an oak brushy area.
Super brushy, super super sagebrush, like thick, thick, thick. And this year is so grown up compared to the year before. But my adrenaline's going, and so I don't even realize. Like, by the time I get to the closest point I can while still on public, I've got cuts all over my arms.
Just shredded, hands,
And that, like, comes back to bite you, because if you get an infection, you're screwed for the rest of your hunt. So, like, I'm just, like, trying to be a little wiser about some of these things. I get closer, and I realize it's a bachelor group of bulls. Second day of the season, afternoon, five bulls, two spikes.
Nice.
Maybe 600 yards as a crow flies. Pretty heavily onto private, but I'm watching them. I'm the only one in this area. There's no hunters on this private, and I am thrilled. So excited.
You're in the game.
And as I notice that I'm in the game, I also notice a storm cloud rolling in. And this is when you're in your head of like, well, real hunters stay out and hunt. I could either go back to my truck.
That's what they make rain gear for,
And so I put on my expensive Sitka rain gear.
There you go.
Got it through a discount because a buddy of mine had a coupon code, which was nice. But put it on, and I start gently cow calling at this elk. They don't really care. And so I start ripping bugles. Rain starts coming down. And one of them just gets fired up, starts ripping bugles back at me. And we're going back and forth. I'm snuffing out his bugles with my bugles. He's chuckling. I'm hearing every elk sound I've ever heard some guy on the internet imitate in real life. And it is thrilling. And then there's this one point where I just see a streak coming from uphill, downhill, charging. And I was like, he's coming to me. Like, I don't know what's happening, but I know he's coming right
game
here
on.
Right now.
Heck yeah.
So I grab my bow. I have my rangefinder. I slip about 20 yards downhill. I'm on a pretty steep incline, maybe like a 30 or 40 degree angle. Pretty tall, brush grass. I don't know what to call it. Like almost like wheat. That's growing on the hillside. And so I get to a place where I have a shooting lane about 40, 50 yards out to my right, 40, 50, 60 yards in front of me, maybe 40, 50, 60 yards to my left. And then these little pockets of brush and timber, not really timber, like just big oak brush. And for some reason, I'm expecting the elk to come from my right side. Everything is downhill from me. And I get into my setup 20 yards in front of where I was calling, and I see antler tips out of my left corner of my eye down the hill, guesstimate like 50 yards. And so I start ranging, and I get 25 55 75 25 55 75. I was like, oh, come on.
Oh, man.
And I can see his face, and I see the antlers, and it was a 6x6. It was the biggest bull in the group, just trying to assert his dominance.
Yeah.
And so this is where your mind is moving a mile a minute and time is happening at a glacial pace. Like you experiencing every experience you can have. So I'm like, okay, do I wait? Do I call? Do I cow call? What do I do? What do I do? What do I do? Drop down to my hands and knees. The second I crouch, I'm out of his eyesight.
Yeah.
So I army crawl out of there, and I move, and he moves, and I move, and he moves. And I got him broadside at 52 yards. I see his body. I range. I clip my release on my D loop, and he is gone. He is out of my life, back onto the private. I'm watching him, and I watch him for the rest of the day. 2-3 hours, the rain goes away. He's eating some food. I'm eating some food.
So here's one of those moments where I'm always left wondering, and I'm not a great elk hunter.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just not.
Yeah, yeah.
My own admission. That's one of those moments where, man, a decoy might have just held his attention just enough longer to allow you to get that shot.
100%.
You know, and I mean, totally, hey, it's one of those things that you learn, you know, live and learn. And you know what? He may have come in and said, oh, that's a cow. That's not the bull I'm after.
Mm-hmm.
And left because he wasn't necessarily ruddy yet. But I mean, you know, who knows? But
it's, and it wasn't, I should go buy a decoy. It's that decoy's in my truck. I have it. I thought about it. And the other thought was, it's opening day. Or it's like the second day, you're going to have experiences. Let's not impede ourselves with new attachments and things hanging off.
Sure,
and Velcro sounds. And But the other thing is, I think in a calling setup, it's super wise, especially solo. Just put an elk near you, behind you, somewhere where it's going to just
so I've only killed
calm them down.
Three bulls.
Yeah.
Calling them in.
Uh-huh.
And all three of them, I was solo.
Yeah.
So, and all three of them, I had the decoy. And
on your bow?
No, this was pre-bow mounted decoys. Yeah. And I mean, no, I've used the Montana decoys for years.
Sure.
I do think that bow mounted decoy, that Ultimate Predator, is probably the ticket.
It's pretty slick.
I just haven't pulled the trigger myself. But truly, I think that every single one of those bulls came in, and when they saw that decoy, it took their attention off the noise of the call,
mm-hmm.
because it's just me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, they've
echolocated you.
Oh yeah, absolutely. They're outstanding at identifying the exact location that noise is coming mm-hmm. from. And I mean, no matter how good your camo is, they're also equally good at figuring out what doesn't belong.
Like to hold up until they know what's going on.
Yeah, of course. And so that, I think that decoy gave just enough time to stop and hesitate for me to get a good shot off.
Yeah. It's trust me, that was my first thought. I was like, you own this thing and that's why you own it.
That's right.
I guess year three is when we'll have to make it pay for itself. But
there you go.
It's interesting in the moment of being able to recognize, like, this is the moment. Like, you know, you go out elk hunting, you may have an encounter, like, this is that encounter.
You might.
It happened. And so in my head, I'm already like, if he comes back in, I'm naming this bull, fool me twice. He's coming back in.
That's right.
I'm going to put him on my wall. But he wanted no more fight that day.
No. That's the thing with those mature animals. You tend to get one chance.
Yeah.
And I mean, you may get lucky and get a second chance, but it's not all, that's not always the case. I mean, that's,
it was really informative just in terms of like how confident you need to be and how patient you need to be and where that interface is.
Well, and that's the tricky part. And truly in my opinion, that comes with experience.
Sure.
And it comes with experiencing some success. And once you do, I've always felt that once you get that first animal on the ground,
yeah,
it kind of demystifies the process somehow. And I don't know quite how to explain that really, mm-hmm. but truly once you get that first one down, it seems like that second one and third one and on just come that much easier because you figured out that missing piece of the puzzle.
Mm-hmm. You because put it together it is, once.
It's a big puzzle, man. And I yeah. mean, trust me, I could wallpaper a wall in my office with all my unpunched tags trying yeah. to figure that last piece of the puzzle out.
Yeah.
But once you do, you kind of figure out how to engage that kind of kill mode, so to speak, you know, and that
it makes sense
what to do in that last 100 yards.
I do feel a big shift, not only in like internal pride for like my current level of endurance compared to a year ago, the number of encounters compared to a year ago, like just the leveling up of how much closer we did get. But I totally see it. And the thing is, like, you can only gain those experiences one at a time. Like, you have the experience and you learned your lesson and now you incorporate it.
That's
why it takes a wall of tags to get successful three times.
For most of us, it does. Yeah. I mean, if you know, some people have a good teacher, a good coach that they kind of, a mentor that they've worked with who speeds that process up a lot.
Yeah.
But most of us don't. And most of us didn't. I mean, my gosh, dude, I had people I'd ask questions to, but I mean, I just went out there and pounded the hills until I found one that was dumb enough to sit there long enough for me to get a shot off.
Yeah.
And then the next year, you know, went from a doe to this big velvet buck up in the middle there. And I mean, that was, again, I mean, it was, I took what I'd learned that year before and applied it to this. And so that year I knew what to expect
mm-hmm.
when I was at full draw with actual fur on the other side of my sight pins, you know, rather than a 3D target. And I mean, I knew that adrenaline and I knew what I needed to do to keep that at bay.
Yeah.
And I knew what, you know, you just kind of learn these little things. And
it's super interesting. I had continued to, like, the next day I saw some single digits of elk and like, I was really still proud of myself, think I expect there to be elk there. Yeah, they're there. They're far away. They're on the edge of public private, sure. But like that's where they're going to be. And just to be like, I kind of have a small sense of in this couple thousand acres of how they're going to move, where they're going to go.
So I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
Did you see more hunters on opening day, or did you see more hunters on that following Saturday? Because this is a question that we asked and we weighed very heavily when it was time to, when the decision was made to go to a, well, we had originally, it was supposed to be September 1st through 30th for the mm-hmm. season dates. And then CPW moved it to the 2nd to make it coincide with bear.
Right.
So we would have 0 days of, you know, unimpeded hunting time, but you know, that's another story, another discussion for another time. But this was one of the things we were truly wondering is there are potentially lost weekends, and yeah. let's face it, most of us work for a living and sure. we can't take the entire month of September off to go chase bugles or chase velvet.
Yeah. You know?
So that was the question we were wondering was, how will that impact the pressure that we as bow hunters feel?
Yeah.
And the pressure that the animals feel. I mean, those first couple of days of the season, I mean, there's going to be times and places where you'll have that just about to yourself because people won't be out till the weekend.
Yeah. I noticed that in this specific spot, the guys who knew what they were doing were there.
Like, they were there.
They were there. The guys who had been there before were there because they knew they needed to be there.
Hey, they've been waiting 335 days too.
Yeah. and that's the thing. It's like, okay, this is where the general public access is in this area. So the people who figured it out over the years kind of came up with their game plan 1 year ago, 15 years ago, but they're executing
it. Yeah.
However, the second weekend of the season, I hunted a couple different areas and saw so many cars at the trailhead.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's a function of it was a bit closer to Denver or those were day use areas, so all the cars are going to be in one spot. But I noticed more activity in other locations.
Could have been a combination of those things. I mean, obviously,
yeah.
You know, the closer you get to the population centers of, you know, Denver, the Springs or Fort Collins, I mean, obviously that is going to ramp up the pressure.
I met a military guy who's out with his daughter for muzzleloader. She's a high school senior. And he's like, yeah, he did 13 miles on foot yesterday. I was like, oh my God, leave this girl alone.
Man, it happens. And that's kind of the funny thing. Okay, so he's out with his teenage daughter.
Yeah.
And he's just crushing miles.
And she seemed fine.
Yeah, and let's be honest. You know, some kids are going to absolutely thrive on that. That's going to be just, wow, give me more. Give me more. But not every kid is.
No.
And, I'm sure he knew his daughter well enough to know what to expect.
Yeah.
But, man, I mean, there's just as many kids who are going to be like, hey, you know, the next year when dad puts her in for a tag, she'd be like, hey, why don't you save your money?
Yeah, let's put the kibosh on that one.
I don't know that I need to do another 28 miles in 3 days up and down the flat tops with dad, you know.
Man, it's wild. So the rest of my archery season was really interesting, but that was the most exciting part. I don't need to necessarily bore our listeners with mini encounters.
But if you think about it, those first few days when the elk are just becoming accustomed to the hunters being in the woods.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, as much as people want that, and again, I need to qualify this statement by once again saying, I'm a crappy elk hunter. I suck at it. It's not something at which I excel. But, you know, the elk hunters want that last week of September because they feel that is when the rut is peaking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you're going to get the most bugling and most reaction to the calls.
Yeah.
And that could very well be true. But I still contend that those first few days are where it's at.
They're nice. And what I've realized is, like, for me, solo hunting, I need to get an elk down where I could get it out. So on the end of the season, that might be a little deeper than on the opening of the season.
Very well can.
You know?
Very well can be. And that's when it pays to have friends, Jake.
Yeah, I'm working on that part. Still working on that part. Email friends@cbapod.com.
There you go.
So I am very curious as to how the story of this, formerly velvety fuel steer head.
He still has a lot of velvet on it.
Yeah. But I saw you posted about it. For our listeners, you could check out at Big Chief Whack-A-Buck to see some photos of the deer we're about to talk about. But yeah, as much as you can tell me about this hunt, I don't need GPS coordinates, but just the highs and the lows.
My GPS is broken anyway. Okay, good. It's my standard answer. My GPS is broken. My apps don't work, and you know, all that. But
celestial navigation's off.
That's
at the moment.
That's all I just do it all by feel. For me and you, I mean, our hunt started very similar. I tried to get out there as much as I can before the season starts as humanly possible. And I mean,
if it's a place you've been before. Action.
Of course. So I view scouting for deer hunting. Scouting for me is very different. I mean, for elk, a lot of people are just scouting for elk. I'm scouting for a buck, maybe two or three bucks, maybe five bucks that I'm trying to keep tabs on, that I'm, as I call it, I'm babysitting them throughout the summer.
Yeah.
And quite often these are bucks that I've watched over a span of a couple of years. And I mean, it's all public land. So at any given moment, those bucks could all be dead this Saturday on the opening day of second season. I mean, that's, you know, so the bucks that I'm hoping make it to next year very well may not.
And I guess that's why it's good to have more than one.
Yes, indeed. So I always go into a hunt. I go into a hunt with a couple plans. First of all, and this is what my scouting teaches me.
Yeah.
So I go into it with a couple of bucks, and And when I say a couple of bucks, if I find a herd that has eight bucks in it and three of them are bucks that I would gladly, you know, hunt, well, that's still just one buck. I still count that as one buck.
That makes sense.
I want to find multiple herds in multiple locations so that when I inevitably go in and blow a stock, it's bow hunting, I'm going to do it. I'm getting better, but I'm not, you know, there. I'm not a one and done stalker just yet.
We're getting there.
Yeah. And so, but when I get to that, I want to have a few different bucks in a few different locations and a few different herds. So
dissect that a little bit, in a hikeable distance, I'm going back to the trailhead and driving around the other side of the mountain.
Oh man.
A little bit of both.
Most often they're in different locations.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, hey, I'd love it if they were all in, you know, little hikeable locations, but that's just not how it usually works out for me. I'll put in the work, and then what I want to do then is before I start really ranking these bucks and saying this is 1A, 1B, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get to know those bucks and find out which one I have the best opportunity to be able to make a play on.
Based on their behavior?
Based on the location where they live, and based on also, and this is real important for me, the number of bucks that they hang out with.
Really?
So, so let's go back to that herd of eight.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've got eight bucks in that herd. You've got eight sets of eyes, eight sets of ears, eight noses that you've got to contend with to be able to get into range. So solo bucks are my favorite. I mean, if a buck is by himself, my son and I stalked a buck this year, and it did not have a great ending for me. In fact, it had a very bad ending for me.
Oh,
but
no.
I don't want to call it the buck of my dreams, but it most definitely was the buck of my dreams. And this buck was huge. I've watched him for 2 years. Last year, I had this buck dead to rights a couple times and said, he's big, he's good buck. He really truly was. But I knew that he was young, and I knew that if he got another birthday, he could be something special. Mm-hmm. And somehow in heavily hunted heavily hunted public land, I mean, he made it through.
Yeah.
Made it through all of archery and muzzleloader season, three rifle seasons.
Wow.
And came back awesome this year.
Wow.
So this is and I haven't told this story yet. I've been saving it for the podcast.
Appreciate that.
So anyway, I'll go through the first 3 days of the season.
I'd love that.
Buck. All right. So this is where you look at the bucks on my wall and you go,
this guy's a fraud. He bought these all at pawn shops. So opening day, I get in there, and my highly patternable buck that I've seen every time I've gone out this summer ghosted me.
Oh, no.
Like, all right, that, it happens. Not a big deal. Got 27 more days, you know, to get this right.
Sure.
So the next morning, I decided I was going to relocate and go to a different glassing point. Okay. Gave me a little bit different vantage. And I got up there on this glassing point, up in these big rocks, and I am feeling like the smartest man alive because the second deer I saw that morning was him.
No way.
And I spotted him at 550 yards. So I just range things. It's what I do.
I'm always
trying to see where I am, and it's all calibrate, part of my planning and stuff. And so I see him at 550. I watch him for about a half hour as he's just feeding along. Feeds down, meets up with this other buck, small little 3-point. And they feed behind this little ridge for a minute, you know, probably 10, 15 minutes. My heart is broken. I know I'm never going to see this deer again, even though it's wide open and I should be able to see him within just a few minutes.
But yeah.
There's always that doubt. You know?
Yeah, he's gone forever.
So he's gone. He pops back up over the hill and starts feeding right towards me.
No way.
I'm like, oh my gosh.
Is there a valley between you two? Or are you just on the same plane?
Bunch of rolling hills on the same ridge line. Like you said, finger ridges.
Gotcha.
There. So now I'm looking down below me going, I might get a shot here. Day two of the season. This doesn't happen to me.
Ever.
And so anyway, I said, okay. I look back down there, and next thing I know, here comes a group of does. So, I mean, like a group of a dozen does.
Oh, no.
With a couple little, and then here comes a couple little bucks. Well, they all meet up together, and they decide, you know what? This is the day. We're just going to rage. We're just going to rage here on this ridge line. And so they're all together. And they're like goofing around. And I mean, it was so cool just sitting there watching deer doing deer things. I love doing this. And so I'm watching him and I'm looking, and I'd ranged one spot down below me at like 78 yards. And I'm like, okay, if he crosses right there, I'm going to take this shot. I'm confident in this shot. That buck's going to die.
Yeah.
So I'm watching it, and here they come. They're feeding their way towards me. And finally, I look over. I'm like, man, they've got to be under 200 yards now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is getting real.
Yeah.
So at some point, so I pick up my rangefinder, and I'm just like, how far out are they? Blank. Oh. My rangefinder is stone cold dead.
Oh, no.
I've received zero battery notifications. So I'm like, that's okay. It's okay.
Uh-huh.
I always have an extra battery.
Uh-huh.
So I reach into my backpack and reach into my Ziploc bag where I carry. I've got a quart size Ziploc bag that has a couple snacks. It's got my battery, my extra blades for my knife, you know, some rubber gloves and all that stuff. And I'm ready. So I reach in there and I reach under all of the loud, you know, Clif Bar wrappers and stuff.
Yep.
And grab this extra battery. And very quietly, with as little movement as possible, swap out the battery and pull the rangefinder back up to find out that that battery is also dead. So,
killing me.
My redundancy has failed me.
Yeah.
But the funny thing was, about a week earlier, and I always swap out my batteries the week before the season. And
yeah.
I just had so much going on, and I'm like, you know what? I had the thought to do it. I'm like, I'm not going to worry about it because I've got a lot going on, and I've got that extra battery. No. I'll be fine. So now, after I am pinned, I'm sitting in these rocks, and they walk down below me, and he chooses a slightly different path, and I'm pretty sure he's in that same distance range, but I don't know for sure. And so I have a self-imposed limit.
Yep.
If he's beyond 60 yards, if I don't have a rangefinder, no shots being taken.
Yeah.
So I sat there and watched the buck of my dreams at a distance that I know I'm deadly.
Mm-hmm.
Have an absolutely world-class sneezing fit for like 30 seconds.
Really?
Where he does not move anything but his head,
broadside to me.
No.
And all I can do is look at it and
that's so tempting.
Silently chuckle to myself. And I thought about it. I'm sitting here sliding my sight, but I didn't know. I didn't know. And I'm like, you know what? I'm not taking a chance.
And you're by yourself.
By myself.
Yeah.
And so anyway, as they fed over the hill, I threw all my crap back in my backpack, put my my binos and tripod and spotter away, and moped my way back to my truck.
Oh boy.
Where I got back to camp, and two of my buddies are coming back up, the Lang brothers, and I said, "Man," they said, "What happened?" I said, "I hate bow hunting." I said, "I'm just done with it. I'm done with it. I don't want to do this anymore." Yeah. And I said, "You know, I can't do this anymore. I cannot take this heartbreak anymore." And so as I'm telling him what's happened, he goes, "Well, did you try? You swapped out the battery." He goes, "Have you tried another battery?" And so I do have redundancies. I do have a backup range finder in my truck. I pull the battery out of there, put it in there. Everything works fine.
No, like, it's not the rangefinder.
Got to be kidding me. So it's not the rangefinder, which is, I guess, good news.
Yeah.
So anyway, run into town, bought all the rangefinder batteries they had at that store, and now I am more than set for the future.
I did have that thought when I was getting those three ranges, 25, 55, 75, is there a more pinpoint rangefinder than this? Is there something that could thread the needle? Is there something that,
and you know,
I don't know.
Yeah, there might be.
Yeah.
And the one thing I would do is when you're out at the range and you try to simulate something like that.
Yeah.
And if there's somebody else there, borrow their rangefinder.
Yeah.
See which one's getting, you know, kind of through the grass.
Because in that moment, I could have charged you about $250 for a battery, and you would have.
I would have paid that $250 and smiled and said, "I would have gladly paid more."
It's so interesting, because that's what I'm thinking. I'm using some Vortex equipment. I like it, but it's entry level equipment, and I'm just sitting there wondering. I'm like, "Did I fuck?
Is there a better option? Yeah. Is there a better option that I should have chosen?" So anyway, the next morning, I'm back out there, back to my original glassing spot now.
Okay.
And first light, first buck, there he is.
Really? Like, again?
Perfect. Well, I've seen him
3 days in a row.
I've seen him 2 days in a row. The first day he ghosted me.
Gotcha.
So this is day three. So I run back to my truck because I watched him feed until like 8:30, 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
And then he fed over this ridge line. I'm like, I know where he's going, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
But I also know that an extra set of eyes would be super helpful in trying to relocate him in his bed over there. So I run back to my truck. I run back to camp. I grab my son, and we went out and hiked way down and around, big loop, you know, couple mile loop around to get on this opposite hillside.
Okay.
And we're sitting there watching him, or we're sitting there looking at the glass in this hillside. Nothing. Finally, I see an ear flicker at 680 yards.
Through binos?
Through my 18s on a tripod.
Wow.
And now I know he's 680 yards because my rangefinder works. So I'm looking, and all of a sudden I see the ears flicking, and I'm trying to get Kyle lined up on him so he can get the spotter on him.
Because
I brought his small spotter. I left my jumbo one at the, you know, back at camp.
Yeah.
I knew this was going to be a big loop, and I knew if things went our way, we're going to want as little weight in our packs begin that pack out as possible. So anyway, we're sitting there watching this buck and watching this ear flicker in there, and I can now see the shape of a deer bedded under this tree with a little bush there, and all of a sudden he just jumps up and runs back up over the ridge where he had come from the morning before.
Okay.
But it's not the big buck.
Okay.
It was this little spike that had been hanging out with him. And so I'm like, okay, Kyle, he's close by. And now we have a starting point for where we really need to hone in.
You know that he's going to be with this other.
He's going to be within 100 yards or so of that
deer.
That's just kind of how they tend to do it in this area. And so I'm watching, and all of a sudden, like a friggin' apparition, this buck just appears.
Wow.
He had been bedded behind a bush that we just couldn't see.
Mm-hmm.
Stands up, walks 150 yards, kicks two does out of a bed and drops down right behind this big rock.
Okay.
And I said, Kyle, if this wind will pick a direction at any point this afternoon.
Yeah.
And I had very little confidence it would, because it had been, you know, as a hunter, you're always monitoring in the back of your mind, monitoring that wind.
Mm-hmm.
And it was swirling like we were in the middle of a friggin' tornado.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I said, what we need to do is we need to loop back around, get back on that first ridge that on the ridge he's on.
Yeah.
Get a couple hundred yards away, and if it stabilizes, even for just a short time, we need to get really aggressive.
So do you mark it on your map?
I don't. I take pictures on my phone.
Yeah.
Typically, I'll take pictures on my phone. I've done the Onyx pin before, but
yeah.
And this is an area that I know real well. I
mean, yeah.
I've hunted it for a while. I've glassed it a lot. I've hiked around there a lot. So we make a big loop around, and we get up above him, and I mean, I'm slipping my boots off, putting on, I bought these Gulo stalkers this year from some guys in New Mexico.
Nice.
Very, very cool foot covering for close in stalking.
Yeah.
And I put those on, and I literally look over and realize I hadn't brought anything for my son. So he's sneaking in Solomon's.
Uh-huh.
But there was just enough breeze that it covered enough of our sound. So we got up there to 200 yards.
Okay.
Or what I thought was 200 yards.
Okay.
It was about 70. Everything was way closer than I thought it was over there. So that was where it just kind of that perspective.
Yep.
And I'm surprised that it fooled me so much, because I do know that area.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I got over there and I'm like, okay, we're pretty close. And all of a sudden, the wind just shifted, and it just got almost perfect.
Right.
Close enough that I'm like, I'm going for it. Let's do it.
Yeah.
So I said, stay right behind me. Step where I step. And I don't know why I told him that. He knows this. He's been with me on several stalks. And we actually had a stalk real similar to that on that buck with the velvet hanging down there.
Yeah,
we snuck into 30 yards on that buck and shot him in his bed. So anyway, we're sneaking up here. We're on this giant rock, and he's under the slightly smaller rock right in front of us. So we get up there, and I peek over the top. And I mean, you know, it's a step and looking side to side,
yep.
A step looking side to side. And when we got to where we could see that rock down below us, I ranged it. And my first thought was, holy crap, we're way closer than I thought.
How close were you?
I'm always hoping for a 40 to 50 yard shot.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of reasons for that. And number one is I'm more calm
at
40 to 50 yards.
Yeah.
The deer are more calm at 40 to 50 yards. Everything is just more calm and relaxed at 40 to 50 yards.
Right.
I'm at 30. And I'm like, crap. I am literally 31 yards away from this rock.
That's insane.
And I know, or I'm 33 yards away from the rock, but I know I've got another step to take, and I know he's probably a half step closer. So anyway, whatever the math was, but he was 32, 33 yards away.
Yeah.
So I peek over, I get a direction of which way he's bedded facing, and his rack covered almost his entire body as he is bedded there.
No way.
So literally, I draw back, I take a half a step forward and kind of creep up tall enough that I can clear the edge of the rock I'm on to get into him. And my pin is everywhere, Jake. I'm a little jacked up, all right? And I told you I always calm down when I'm at full draw.
Yeah.
So I had a little conversation with myself, and I told myself, you know, calm the hell down and put that pin where it needs to go.
Right.
And I took a little bit of a breath, and I kind of let it out, and I settled that pin. And as I'm settling the pin, he moves his head forward, because the does, which had that he had bumped out of their beds, were bedded directly under the rock I'm on.
Oh, wow.
I mean, if I would have jumped off that rock, I could have jumped down with a knife and started killing does. That's how close I was.
That's
to him.
Nuts.
It was nuts. And this is two of us that have snuck in this close.
Yeah.
My son's right on my heels. And so I make he starts kind of getting antsy because the does are antsy. And I think I sped up my process a little more than I should have, but I got that pin on him, made what I felt was, you know, maybe not 100% my best shot, but like a 70% best shot. Still should have been more than good enough to put it where I wanted it to go. Shot goes off. It hits with a whack.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my gosh, did I just miss him and hit the rock he's bedded behind? Which I knew I didn't.
Right.
But that it was that
surprised
loud.
You. Yeah.
And so anyway, at the shot, I mean, just all hell broke loose, Jake. There were two does go taking off one direction. The buck takes off. He's limping. I'm freaking out. Uh-huh. You know, my son's behind me going, I look back. I mean, his eyes are just as big as saucers, you know. And he's of like, course. What the heck? And, ooh, we got a little lightning and
a little thunder action out here.
A little thunder and lightning in late October here. So, but anyway.
What was it? Did you connect to the shoulder blade? Or
that all I can think of is that I must have just absolutely smoked, because as he's bedded, that leg's tucked back up behind him.
Yeah.
I think I just smoked that elbow joint.
Yeah.
Because the weird thing is I found my arrow like 20 feet later.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, he had kicked it out immediately, and it only had about 4 or 5 inches of penetration.
Oh.
And I've been a shot placement advocate for years over, you know, Band-Aids and crutches such as heavy arrows and single bevels, and I still am.
Mm-hmm.
But truth be told, I mean, that was a tough pill to swallow, man. I mean, there was not a drop of blood.
Yeah.
The arrow had blood on it the first 4 or 5 inches, but that was it.
Yeah.
You know, broadhead fully deployed, nothing.
Oh, no.
So, I mean, I'm in meat and bone, and that's it.
Oh, man.
So next, since we weren't sure, we backed out. It was late afternoon anyway. We backed out. I'm back in there the next morning, glassed that entire basin before I went down trudging in and started grid searching.
Right.
Like 8 miles of grid searching later,
ugh,
I walked out.
Nothing.
Back in there the next day. Back in there the next day. I took the day after that off because I had to get some repairs on my truck, and then back in there the next day.
Wow.
I spent 6 days looking for that buck.
Damn.
And not a drop of blood, just a buck with a limp.
Damn. That stinks.
The most gutting feeling. I mean, again, this is a buck that I've watched for 2 years.
Yeah.
I'm ready. I've waited. I've done my homework. I've done my preparation. You know how much I shoot. I mean, I take the preparation for hunting extremely seriously.
Yeah.
My bow was dialed, everything was ready, and to this day I'm not sure what happened.
Oh man, that's so frustrating.
So yeah, that was how my season started.
Yeah, that's a crazy opening week.
Not ideal. Yeah. So had the encounter I dreamt of. And you know, sometimes no matter what you do, no matter how hard you prepare, sometimes things just don't go your way.
Yeah, man.
And so a couple days later, I'd regrouped and kind of said, all right, we need to get back out there and start hunting. I mean, there is zero doubt in my mind that that was not a fatal hit.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just not enough penetration to get through a shoulder.
Is that how you like make the decision in terms of like going back out there versus?
Yeah. And let's face it, it's bow hunting and things do happen.
I mean, I wounded a grouse. I wounded a turkey earlier this year.
Hey, I mean, I've been on enough blood trails of my own and my friends that you get to know what is and what isn't.
Yeah.
So a few days later I got back out and I'm like, all right, I'm going to go to my secondary spot. And I got in there and, I glassed up an absolute ton of deer the night before.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, man, if it's anything like this tomorrow morning, it's going to be game on. I'm going to be thrilled, you know? I got out there the next morning and it was.
Wow.
I mean, it was unreal. There were freaking deer everywhere.
Man, it's got to feel good.
The absolute giant I was looking for, I hadn't relocated him, played a little cat and mouse with a real nice buck and had a I had him between 70 and 100 yards for about a half hour. And I mean, just a great, great deer. And was at full draw on him twice. And he just slipped right through the little openings too quickly. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, and I had one shot that was, I mean, I had an opening, but it wasn't, you know, I just sat there. I'm like, nah, I'm not risking it. And so I let down on him twice. And wow. He kind of bounced off. And I said, you know what, the heck with it. I'm just going to go check on the other side of the ridge here and see if there's any deer left over there. It's funny because I peeked over the ridge and there's three deer down there. And I'm looking at them like, you know, a couple of what I call birthday bucks.
Yeah.
You know, bucks that would benefit from another birthday or two.
Right, right.
And one of them kind of had my interest a little bit. And I'm like, nah, it's too early. I'm going to hold out. And then I took about three more steps down the hill. And again, I'm in some pretty thick oak brush too. And I'm like literally pulling branches aside so I can sneak down through there. Cause I'm only like 70, mm-hmm. 80 yards from these bucks. And I look down this little finger ridge and there's another buck. And there's actually two more bucks down there, but one of them was nice.
Yeah.
And I took a quick look through my binos and I'm like, man, he's not too far away.
Right.
And I looked and I'm like, okay, I see the sticker going out one side. And generally a cheater's enough for me to get my attention.
Yeah, yeah.
I saw the mass. I mean, he was a real heavy buck. I saw that one cheater out the outside. And then most of my scouting that I do during the summer is from a long ways away.
Yeah.
I'll try to do it from a mile away or a half mile away through big optics and, you know, yeah. watching so they don't know I even exist.
Right, right.
So this was the first time I'd seen this buck up close.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw the cheater on the inside making him a 4x6, and I'm like, yeah, that's
go time.
That's exactly what I needed. So I sat there and I'm like, all right. He was the way the buck was looking back up. The sun was rising behind me, so he could kind of see movement on this ridge, but he didn't. I don't think he could necessarily tell what I was.
Yeah.
So he was kind of looking up there, but he was looking back over his butt. You know, like when they're like facing away, but
sure.
craned back, looking back at you.
Yeah.
And I sat there and I said to myself, all right, he's 71 yards because again, my rangefinder's working now because nice. I have a battery
Smart.
And a good backup battery.
I was going to say,
cause I learned my lessons, but I learned most lessons the hard way.
Yeah.
And I'm by my own admission. And so anyway, I look back down and I'm like, you know what? If he gives me a broadside shot, I'm taking it.
Yeah.
I'm just going to take it. This Gotta is too it. Good a buck and too good a situation. And it's a shot that I've practiced countless times over at that mule deer at HRCA.
Mm-hmm.
It's like as close to a replica of that shot as you can possibly get. And I have done more than my fair share to wear that target out.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I peek back up over the brush and that sucker's broadside.
Oh, man.
So I'm like, game on. So I drew back and I drew back down low, kind of squatted down. I stood up. Got my feet right, and literally that pin, I leveled up, got my pin on him, and when that shot broke, it felt perfect.
Yeah.
It was, you know, and it was a well-executed shot, and I saw that arrow. I just caught the arrow mid-flight.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've shot enough arrows, you know what it's supposed to look like in
right.
that distance. And I'm like, oh, he's screwed.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good feeling to feel confident in the air.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, he's not going to like that. And it just hit with a good thud. And literally I watched that deer run maybe 50 yards.
Yeah.
And when I shot him, he was in just perfect pristine velvet.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in the next 20 yards, he started flopping and rolling and just shredded that velvet. I mean, he's got it hanging off and
looks clumps, like he went through one of those log mulchers.
Yeah, it does. It really does. I mean, the velvet shredded, but yeah. My taxidermist preserved it. And I think it just makes for a cool mount because
totally.
It's just part of that story, you know, to be able to preserve it exactly how it was.
And, yeah.
But yeah, I ultimately watched him drop. I watched him go down and I mean, it was, it was the validation of a good hunt. And unfortunately, I'd had that bad experience the week before.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, I'd done everything I could to recover that deer. But dang, man, sometimes this happens.
Yeah.
It wasn't ideal. And trust me, we will be, I've been out there looking for that buck numerous times since.
Yeah.
And I still haven't been able to relocate him. But
yeah.
I think he's found a secondary living spot that, because again, he went off with a limp.
Right.
No blood loss, but with a limp. And I don't know, man. I mean, we've seen, I killed a deer in 2015 that was walking totally normally.
Mm-hmm.
No problems, none at all.
Yeah.
And when I got up and found him after I'd shot him and I walked up on him, I looked at his front leg and that like elbow joint had just this giant scar tissue build up on
uh-huh.
it. And I mean, I have no idea what happened to it. I cut into it and I didn't see anything.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was just, I mean, they're incredibly resilient animals.
They really are. It is wild to see. Well, congratulations on this one, man. And
yeah, it was pretty awesome. But like I said, you know, hey, just as you in your second year of hunting had a season filled with lessons.
Yeah.
Most of them hard learned.
Oh yeah.
You know, cause we're men and that's how we tend to learn lessons.
Sure.
I'm well past my second year of hunting.
And yeah.
I had some hard earned lessons myself this year. And I mean, it's, you know, you reevaluate everything and you look at it and you're like, man, should I have waited for him to stand? Should I? But I mean, in that particular situation, As I sat there and assessed that situation in the, you know, 30, 40 seconds before I stood up and decided to take that shot, I sat there and I thought, what are the odds? And I mean, you get pretty good at evaluating these things pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But my first question was, what are the odds of me being able to get that shot off when he stands up? Because when yeah. he stands up, he's going to see us. And at this range, at 30 yards, he's going to see us and he's going to be gone.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not going to be, there's very likely not going to be an opportunity for a shot.
Yeah.
And then my second question was, there's two does right down below me that I cannot see. I know they're there, but I cannot see exactly where they are. What if they get up to feed a minute or two before the buck does? They see me, they blow out.
Yeah.
No doubt the buck's going to stand and run. I mean, so I did feel that was my best opportunity, my highest percentage opportunity.
Sure.
It's not how it turned out.
Yeah. But,
you know.
And like you have to kind of make these parameters for yourself and try to operate within them and understand that like it's still not a perfect system, but
yeah,
you are operating within like your ethical boundary. Because that's what I was thinking too, is I'm on the edge of the border of public and private. What if this thing runs downhill, which it will, 40 plus yards, which it will, it's not going to be on public land. Yeah. And do I back out a few miles and call the sheriff? Do I just go down there? Cause I don't see anybody else down. Like what's the ethical thing? What's the right thing?
Yeah.
What's
I mean, the ethical and right thing is obviously back out and, you know, make sure you get access.
100%.
But I mean, hey, I haven't really had to go through that myself.
Yeah.
Well, once, and it went smooth as could be.
Yeah.
But it doesn't always. It does
well,
not
the thing.
Always
it's
go
like
that way.
The absolute right thing to do is do not trespass. Like
100%. Yeah.
Private lands and land rights is like a huge thing in this country, and I think it's important.
Yeah.
However, there's a thing of the second I make this phone call is that's I've started a process which I cannot reverse from
bingo.
Here.
Bingo. Yeah, and that's very true. That the toothpaste is out of the tube, so yeah. to speak. Yeah.
And you made that decision by taking the shot in the location you decided to take the shot in. So yeah. it's all circles in. And just hearing your stories, it's interesting how much you not only learn, but consider in the micro of do I breathe in this moment or take a step with my left foot? And then the macro of should I have just parked at that trailhead or should I come from this angle or that angle? And
I mean, I think... I think the difference between an experienced bow hunter and an inexperienced bow hunter is just the decision making.
Yeah.
It's simply the decision making. And I mean, you feel like with experience, you become good at making decisions and making important and critical decisions that literally, I mean, I've heard Aaron talk about this, that Aaron Snyder talk about this and a number of times about how a new bow hunter will sometimes just kind of suffer a little bit of analysis, you know, paralysis from analysis in those moments, where the more experienced you are, the more confident you are in, okay, here's what I need to do, or, hey, I just need to back out.
Yeah.
I mean, I've backed out of a number of stocks just going, this just isn't going to work. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, literally yards away from being able to make that happen, I've backed out a couple times just saying, no, that's just not, when you see it from a different perspective and you see where the animal's bedded, or you see, you know, something else that you'll see there and you're like, this is not a high percentage situation. I need to back out.
One thing I was spending a lot of time contemplating on, and I actually have like a draft article prepared that I'm going to edit and publish, but the interface between instinct and intuition. And in those moments of being in nature and not dealing with your emails or your cell phone buzzing or just modernity, just being in that pursuit where I find that your instincts are not necessarily the thing you have to listen to, because it's kind of can be your gut reaction, but your intuition comes only from experience. You have to have an experience, a level of knowledge to act on intuition. And so I was telling somebody that, like, sometimes when you're hunting, you're like, I'm going 3 miles down this trail to that point. And sometimes you're like, I really don't know if I'm going to take a step with my left foot or my right foot right now.
Yeah. And really it's a different game too.
Yeah.
You know, for your elk hunt versus my deer hunt. I mean, you know, elk hunting tends to be, you know, full steam ahead and
get aggressive.
You know, let's be aggressive and go make it happen.
Yeah.
Where deer hunting can be extremely passive, and with moments of aggression, you know, of aggressive moves, where it's very, but most of my deer hunts are very calculated.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I'll have watched this deer all summer. And then when it comes time to make that move, you know, it's sometimes you just, I'll look at a situation and be like, no, that's a low percentage stock. I'm mm-hmm. not even going to try it.
Yeah.
And I'll just back out, and, you know, it might be a day or two again before I have another, before he beds in that right opportunity. But that time, and the funny thing is, it makes me sound like I'm incredibly patient. I am not. I can say that, you know, life, fatherhood, and mule deer have taught me patience.
Makes sense.
And well, in coaching lacrosse, because I coach the youth lacrosse team. So you do learn a lot of patience dealing with kids and stuff. But truly, you learn patience by knowing, is this the time I should go make that move?
Mm-hmm.
Is this, you know, is it, should I blow this off and come back another day? Am I better off to wait and come back another day?
Yeah, so, it's
hard.
Seems like a level of maturity as well, because there's times where if I'm like leaving a unit or leaving an area because I'm not seeing a lot of activity, or I'm just physically fatigued, there's a little bit of negative self-speak because I don't have the knowledge of,
well,
like,
there's
you're a loser
no question
for
about
leaving
that,
out.
Jake. No question, because you develop a little bit of confidence once you've gotten a few that, okay, I do know how to make this happen.
Mm-hmm.
And if I continue putting in the work, I will scrounge up another opportunity or two. And, you know, and that's sometimes it's what it takes of, I just need one more chance.
Yeah.
Okay. So where, and then you start going through your Rolodex of, or your files, you know, going, okay, how can I, where can I go next to give myself that another opportunity that I need?
Yeah. I think that's the thing, is like wanting to know where the animals are 365. Like, I want to be that
good
tapped
luck
in. But just that idea.
But I
of,
hear you.
It's not, okay, animals have their guard down on opening day and I might get lucky. It's, I know what I'm doing. I have an approach and I have a plan for this and for that. And so, man, we could keep going for hours and hours.
Yep,
I think
I do smell dinner is almost ready.
I do
ready,
smell some
so.
dinner. So we'll pick this up when we have Trevin tell his stories as well.
There, but you go.
Again, congrats, man. And I appreciate you telling
it.
Me the story. Like, not to sound like a jerk, but it's satisfying hearing how much work you put in versus you saying opening morning, first half hour, I
you
shot
know,
and he's done.
And honestly, had I shot that buck opening morning, half hour into first light, there still would have been, you know, 2 years of scouting put into
absolutely
getting that buck in that, putting myself in that right position. That's never been the kind of hunter I've been, though, man. I mean, as much as I scout, it still takes me a while to get it done.
Yeah.
It's still usually around the middle of September before I put a tag on a deer. But that's, you know, hey, you just, it's all part of the process, and I freaking love the process.
Yeah, man.
Every single step of it.
Good luck this weekend, and we'll have to check in at the end of the season.
Well, good luck in New York.
Thanks, man.
Awesome chatting, Jake.